Okay.
Anyone have nine?
So today we are going to stream our sermon over the web radio. If you could please check that you can hear, and if you have any issues, then please let us know via the chat facility that's on the website. So you can go to dharmaabai.org/radio. If you're connected on Skype, then we put a link to the web radio on the Skype chat, so you can find it there. And we are going to get started now, so please connect with us and share the link out to anyone that you think would benefit or would be interested. If you have any questions as we go along, then you're welcome to either post them on the web radio. There's a chat facility just below the web radio utility, or on the Skype group, and we can pick questions up from there. Okay. So before we get started, as usual, we always pay homage to the perfect one, our Lord Buddha, without whom we would today be helpless and be going through the samsaric process as we have done for an infinitely long period of time. And therefore, as I recite the gatha that we use to pay homage to the Lord Buddha, you can recite that along with me.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
And it's also important that we invite any celestial beings, devas and brahmas, who also benefit from the Lord Buddha's Dhamma. His teaching is universal. He does not belong just to the human beings, but to the entire universe. To anyone that wants to understand the reality of this, of life, understand the reality of existence and how to put a stop to this painful process that is samsara, his teaching belongs to all of them. And therefore, as Buddhists, whenever we discuss the Lord Buddha's Dhamma, we ensure to invite the devas, the gods and the brahmas, so that they may join us in their forms, in whichever way, in whichever forms they are, and listen to this Dhamma. So as I recite the gatha with which we invite the devas, I ask you to recite that in your minds, and by doing that you can extend that not only to the devas and the brahmas, but also to anyone, any of your relatives, any of your relations, your family that you might have had in the past, in your past births, that you've come along, you've lived with, you've got along with, or had any kind of relationship with, who in your previous births you've worked with them, you practiced the Dhamma, you listened to the Dhamma, and therefore today you're fortunate enough to come across this Dhamma, but many of them may not be. And if they are able to, if they are in a form of existence to which they are able to come along and listen to this Dhamma, then it is our duty today to invite them as well, so that they may benefit from the Lord Buddha's teaching and use this Dhamma to put an end to this painful samsara. So as I recite the gatha, can I ask you to extend that in your minds and make that invocation to the devas, the brahmas, and any relations, any relatives that you would have had in your previous birth, who may benefit as well.
Samanta chakravalesu atra gacchantu devata sadhammam munirajasanta sunantu saggamokkadam dhammasavana kalo ayam badanta dhammasavana kalo ayam badanta dhammasavana kalo ayam badanta.
As you know, normally we start our program around 1 o'clock Sri Lanka time, but today there was clearly a delay, and this is because we visited a monastery, a few of us, several monks in the monastery that we are in and who are associated with our program, Dharmayabai. We visited a monastery. It was a rock monastery, and it was such a great feeling when we got there to see that even to this day, you know, even when we've lost all hope of the Sangha, or at least who we refer to as the Sangha, to see that there are members of the Mahasangha who live their lives with the sole purpose that is to attain Nirvana. And they took us around, they were very inviting, they were very happy to receive us. And they took us to the caves, showed us around. You know, this was a place that was inhabited by arahants back in the day. And when they listened to the Dhamma that we talk about, the true teaching of the Lord Buddha, it was obvious that in their minds they knew that this would be a place, or that monastery would be a place where arahants would be born essentially again. And with that hope and intention, they had invited us to find home, to find shelter there. So, you know, in due course, it may be that, you know, some of our own monks may go and settle there as well. You know, it's very peaceful over there. Wherever you look, there is nothing that's artificial. It's all natural. For miles and miles and miles, all you see is just the forest. When you get up onto the rocks, for miles, it's just plain forest there. At a stretch, you can see lakes. Over to a site, you know, and that's where some of the monks that are already resident there go to wash themselves and get water, etc. But it's very calm, very peaceful. There's no, essentially there are no human beings. And it was quite ironical because as we were coming back, I was telling another monk that we went with that in our previous births, particularly in our last one, we did so much sankhara. We did so much sankhara expecting to be born a human being. That's what we wished for, that's what we hoped for, and that's what we worked for. And now that we are born a human being, we try and distance ourselves from human beings as much as possible. The irony of that was quite striking for me. And I think that's because throughout samsara we've been coming along and finding birth, finding existence as various forms. We've been animals, we've been devas, we've been brahmanas, we've been human beings, even in this world. But ever since we entered the clan that is Arya, I think we've found a new existence, a new type of birth. We've been reborn. This includes you as well. You don't have to necessarily robe to be an Arya. All you need to do, and we've discussed the meaning of the word Arya in the past. Rhea is a vehicle, and if you want to stop that vehicle, then you are an Arya. In Sinhala, if you put the letter Ayana in front of a word, then you get the opposite of that. Rhea is a vehicle. So an Arya is someone who wants to stop a vehicle. What's this vehicle? It's the vehicle that we've been going through in samsara. And so you've understood the Dhamma and made a firm decision and a determination. This samsara has only brought me pain and suffering. I have no desire to go through in this samsara again. Then you are an Arya. But that understanding only comes with an understanding of the reality that I mentioned at the start, the reality that the Lord Buddha comes into this world and teaches us, that is anicca, dukkha, anatta. So it is always anicca, dukkha, anatta and nibbana that we talk about in these programs and nothing else, because that's the ultimate gift that we can offer you. For all the dhanas, for all the alms that you offer to the Mahasangha, for all the worshipping that you do, for all the love and care and attention that you give the Mahasangha, you give us the most you have to offer. Whatever you have to offer, you give us the best that you can offer. So therefore, is it not our duty to offer you in return the best that we have? And the best that we have is not necessarily how you can go to a heaven in the next birth, because there are a lot of monks that talk about that, and there's nothing wrong with that. But there's something even more valuable, something even more worthwhile that we talk about, and that is Nibbana. And this is why Shastra Nuhan didn't for a moment say you can find ultimate happiness, ultimate bliss in becoming a deva or a brahma. He said there isn't a pin drop or a pin head, you know how tiny that is, in this entire universe where you can find ultimate happiness and ultimate bliss. And this is why he said, and he said in his own words, this is why I say you have to attain Nibbana. This is why I preach Nibbana. And the Lord Buddha says, if there was even a tiny bit of happiness anywhere in this universe, I would not be preaching Nibbana to you today. So, you know, it's always important to try and understand, to try and remind ourselves why we come together like this. You know, all of you're very busy people. I was one as well. Now I'm a lot more free than I used to be. I had appointments full of diaries, or diaries full of appointments even. People to see, places to go, things to do, all the time. I was always sat down in front of a computer doing something, speaking to someone, trying to play the world the way I wanted it. But it took me a while to realize I was playing a game of poker. Sometimes I won, or at least I felt like I won, when it seemed like things were working out in my favor. But little did I realize it had nothing to do with what I wanted it to be. That wasn't working out how it was because I wanted it to be like that. It was only because there were causes that gave that effect. This is why Shastra Muhansi talks about cause and effect. But after I realized that, after I realized happiness comes to me when you stop seeking happiness, when you stop going after it, when you stop the pursuit of happiness, therein lies happiness. When I understood that, that's when I decided enough is enough. And this is why I'm now practicing a much more simpler life. No responsibility. Except for the responsibility I have, one, to Shastra Nuhansi, and two, to you. Why? Because you, as I said, you know, you do all of this for me, for the Mahasangha, with expecting only one thing in return, and that is for me to fulfill my path, my Nirvana. Fortunately, that is what I want, just as much as you do. And that is what Shastra Mahansa expected of me. So, therefore there is no clash in objectives, there is no clash in goals. Whereas in worldly life, everyone wants a different thing. You go to a supermarket, you want to buy something, you want something, the shopkeeper wants your money, you want the goods, the supplier wants their money, they want, the shopkeeper might want a discount, I want a discount. Everyone wants a different part. The taxpayer wants their money, or the taxman wants their money, the government wants their bit. So everyone wants a part of something. But once you enter the stream that takes you to Nirvana, everyone wants the same thing, and that is to attain Nirvana. No one's pulling in different directions. You're all pulling in the same direction. And therefore the journey becomes much easier. If the path is clear, and you're walking the path, then there's nothing to stop you. As long as you have the determination, you have the energy, you have the effort, you put in the effort to achieve that, nothing's going to stop you, nothing's going to get in your way. So this is what we all expect and strive for. For those of you who might have connected in the last few minutes, as I reminded, if you have any questions, then please do post them either on the web radio, on our website, or on Skype, and we can continue from there. We can pick those questions up. There's something that I've been thinking about of late. So when I came into this monastery, the chief monk in the monastery offered me one of these chalets or kuti. There are a few of them in the monastery, and sometimes we share it with another monk, one or two other monks, because this is too much room for one person. I mean, you know, every time I think about this, I'm reminded of my time as a lay person. You know, when I used to go on holiday, and you book a hotel online, you try and find the one that has the most room, one that gives you the most luxury, the biggest bed. Single bed is not good enough. Even if you're just one person, you want a king size bed, right? You want. It might be that I'm only staying one day, but I want the most that I can afford for my money. I check to see what kind of breakfast they offer. Is it a fixed menu or a buffet breakfast? I always wanted more. What was offered was never enough. This is why I look on one website, I then go on another website and see, how do they come there? Is this the same hotel? Do they offer more for the same price? But now it's very different. Now, a few of us, including this young man here, we have given up these chalets and we found home under a tent. And that's where we spend the night now. We've informed the chief monk that this is too much for us. I don't need a roof over my head. I just need some kind of shelter. As long as it doesn't rain, as long as there's some kind of shelter when the sun's scorching hot, and there's something to protect me from the elements, that's all I need. A mattress is good enough, I don't need a bed. One meal is all I take now, that is perfectly sufficient. I've been doing that for about 8 months. Even before I became a monk, because I thought, this is going to be tough. Geez, how can you survive on one meal? So I tried it. I tried it as an experiment. First, I mean, you know, you as upasakas that listen to this Dhamma, maybe trying to practice some of these things and include some of these things in your own life, right? So I'm guessing you will come across the same decisions, you will come across some of the same challenges as you walk that path. One of the challenges I had was my friends and family. And when I started to cut my meals down, they got really worried. And they said, how are you going to survive on one meal a day? And so I wanted to prove to them that 3 meals a day is not what my body needs. My body needs 1 meal a day. My tongue and my mind need 3 meals a day. And I proved it to them. How? I did everything I used to do on 3 meals on 1 meal. That included going to work, catching the tube to work, walking several hundred yards to and from back from the station, going to the gym after work, spending an hour at the gym every other day. I made it a point not to give up anything because I wanted to prove. And both to myself and to those that were concerned. Yes, I did lose some weight. Over a course of, I think, about 4 months, I was 80 when I started, and I'm now down to 63, something like that. I might have reduced give or take a kilo now, I don't know. I haven't checked in for some time now. But then they said, my God, you've lost a lot of weight. So I pulled up the BMI chart, measured my height, measured my weight, and I was perfect. Perfect healthy weight. So I said, where's the problem now? I was perfectly fine. Didn't have any issues with my health. I wasn't feeling weak. In fact, I was feeling much healthier. I was feeling much better within myself. Why? Because my body wasn't struggling to digest all this food that I was constantly feeding it. Previously, before I made this decision to cut my meals down to what my body needs to function, I now realize that my body was a machine that converted food to feces. That was all my body was. Convert food to something that I pass away. But now, since I cut my meals down to essentially what I need, just to get the nutrients I need, not satisfy my tongue or my mind, this is now a machine that helps my mind, that supports my mind achieve its purpose. And that is to attain Nibbana. I did all the work at home, cleaning, washing up, nothing. I changed nothing. And I was perfectly fine. So, for others who might be interested in trying it, you know how people say, you know, it's really difficult to lose weight? Buddhism offers a perfect solution for that. You don't have to go to these classes that charge you many thousands and, you know, millions of rupees or pounds or whatever. You know, they put you on these diet plans. You know, you diet two days a week, and then eat to your heart's content the other 3 days, and then diet another 2 days. Scrap that. You don't need that. Just eat what your body needs. You can start with stopping snacking. You know how when you walk past the kitchen, you feel like, what's in the drawer? Or you just walk into the kitchen and you open the fridge. You open the fridge to get a bottle of cold water or maybe the milk. And you see a box of chocolates. What do? Automatically your hand goes there. And I, you know, as I've been telling these kids, you know, when you get that desire, make a contract with your mind. And what is a contract? A contract is, I give you something, you get something back, right? So the contract is this. Okay, fine. I'll give you what you want. But first, let's have a little bit of a chat. you can have this chat with your mind. And the chat goes something like this. Okay, why do you want that chocolate? Oh, because, you know, you're hungry. Really? Okay. Go have some rice then. But I just had rice. I thought you were hungry. If you're hungry, you should be able to eat anything. Your mind plays tricks on you like nobody does. You know how people get really annoyed when other people trick them? Like if someone tries to take your money by fooling you, or tries to take something that belongs to you by fooling you, by tricking you, you know, tries to underhand you, you get really annoyed, you get really upset. How can you do something like that to you? Sometimes people go to courts for things like that. But we forget that the biggest trickster is with ourselves, is our mind. Plays tricks on us like nothing else, like nobody else. So when it says, I'm hungry, ask the question, okay, go have some, drink a glass of water. Isn't that going to fix the problem? Or have some rice, just have some plain rice. Isn't that going to fix the problem? Or when you go to a restaurant and you say, what am I going to have, what am I going to order? And your mind's looking at, okay, there's plain white rice, there's fried rice, there's biryani. Oh, biryani rice. Okay. So what are you now trying to feed? Why did you come into the restaurant? Because you're hungry. Okay. So if you're hungry, why do you need biryani rice? Why do you need fried rice? What's wrong with plain white rice? I'm not saying every time you go into a restaurant, you've got to have plain white rice. You know, if you go with friends and family, you know, they'll probably think you're a stingy fellow. You look at the cheapest option on the menu and go, oh, they have plain white rice. That's not what I'm saying, but, you know, get into a habit of having those discussions with yourself. Because that's the way to win this war. The raga, dvesha, moha that's in your mind is always fighting with you. It's always fighting with the wisdom that is within you. Part of your mind is still under delusion. It's still suffering from ignorance. But as people that practice this Dhamma, as people that listen to this Dhamma, there will most definitely be the seed of wisdom that has been planted within you. But you've got to let that plant grow. And to allow that plant to grow, you need to feed it with water, with fertilizer. And in the metaphorical sense, in reality what you need to do is give it chance to grow. Give it sunlight, give it a bit of love. How? You tend to it. You tend to it by allowing it to have a conversation with you. So before you jump into anything, have that conversation. Why do you need it? What are you trying to do by taking this food? What did Shastan Ruhan say, take food for? When we take our food, we remind ourselves, Patisanka yoniso, indapatam patisevami. Neva davaya, namadaya, namandanaya, navibhushanaya, yava deva imastakaya satitiya. I don't take this food for pleasure. I don't take this food to grow my body and build my muscles and be muscular. I don't take this food to pleasure my taste buds. I take this food for one purpose and one purpose alone. Brahmacharyanugrahaya. Iti Puranancha Vedanam Patihankam Navancha Vedanam Naupadisam. If I have suffered from any ailments, from any discomfort due to malnutrition or not having the right nutrients, not taking in enough, not taking input, then may this food comfort me. May this food allow me to practice the path of this Dhamma, practice this path of Nirvana. And remove any discomfort that may arise in the future. That is why we take food. Food is a medicine. Why do we not see food as a medicine? And something that we do in this monastery. I was quite happy yesterday. Someone had offered ice cream. Because we take everything in the same bowl. There's rice, there's pumpkin, there's fruit, there's fish, there's chicken, there's papadam, there's dal curry, there's ice cream, yogurt, coffee, chocolates, everything together. If I have understood that food is medicine, you know how when you take medicine, say you prescribe medicines to a patient and go, you've got to take this for diabetes, this for blood pressure, this for cholesterol, and this for something else you have, you know, take it, say, after meals at night. They don't go, okay, first one, water, second one, water, third one, water. What do? They just take all the things together, put it in, drink a glass of water. There's nothing wrong with that, right? Why? Because it's medicine. What's so different with food then? If, as soon as it goes past your tongue, you have no idea what happens to it, and it's all going into the same place, once it's there, it's all together anyway, what's the big deal about having to separate all of it before, you know, just for the time being it passes your tongue? What's the big deal? That's your delusion fighting with you. Ooh, that doesn't taste very nice. So I hang on a second. I thought we took food for the things that we said before. We should remove any discomfort that has arisen in the past so that it doesn't come back again. And to remove any discomfort that may come in the future. To keep myself free from any ailment, any diseases. And to practice this path of nirvana. It doesn't matter whether they, what flavor it is. What flavors is the tongue sensitive to? Sugar? Or sweet, rather? Sour, bitter, salt, that's it, right? Four major tastes? Yeah? Sour. Sour, right? Yeah. Okay. So those primary tastes. You know how we say when we eat, say we eat a certain type of food. Let's say you're eating a mango curry. You might taste it and go, make it ambulga tima. It's not sour enough. You don't say it's not mango taste enough. Make it ambaraha madigila kyan man. We say there's not enough sour in it, or there's not enough salt in it. What are you actually saying there? You're saying, I can taste the four basic, or four or five basic fundamental tastes, and I'm sensing that something is not enough. So, what you're essentially saying is, these are the four or five things that you can taste. Mango taste is something that you create in your own mind. Your tongue is not sensitive to mango or pizza or sausage or chocolate. It's something you create in your mind. Because you know you're eating mango, and as soon as you know you're eating mango, your mind's now looking, okay, what mango have I tasted in the past? Ah, now that's what it needs to taste like. Now you take all those tastes that come through your tongue, you mix it all together, and now you have something to compare it. You have a taste that you've had in the past, you have a taste that you're experiencing now, now you start this comparison. If it tastes as good as the best mango you've ever tasted, great. If not, you go, I don't like this. So where did that comparison come from? Your own mind. But we don't realize this happening. Why? Because we don't allow for that plant to grow. We don't give it time to get that sunlight. And to give that sunlight is essentially just have that conversation. Before you complain about something. Before you say, I need to go and eat something that is not your main meal. You know, this is why I said you can start by stopping snacking. Then you can cut down to say two meals a day. You don't have to do this, you know, like, it's not like taking a U-turn. It can be difficult like that. That's how I did it. I just decided, right, that's it, one meal a day. Stopped everything else. It was difficult at first, but that I had made my mind up. I mean, I was thinking to myself, if a mind can be so strong and have such determination to become a Samma Sambuddha, what am I trying to do here? Survive on one meal. That can't be so difficult. If a mind can have so much power and so much determination to decide, I am going to sit down under this Bodhi tree, let my blood and my bones and my muscles rot and decay, I am not going to get up from this place until I have attained my goal, my aim, and that is to become a Samma Sambuddha. If a mind has so much power, what am I trying to do? Cut down on snacking. Cut down on meals that I don't need. But you don't all have to try to do that. Do it gradually. And then come to a point where you decide, okay, I'm doing fine on 2 meals a day. Then maybe for a week, try 1 meal a day. Does it work? And if you're thinking, yeah, I'm doing perfectly fine, then you can come to the conclusion, well, all this time, I've been taking food unnecessarily. What happens when you take food unnecessarily? You've got to then treat that ailment as well. It's like, you know, you take medicines, you take too much medicine, now you've got to treat your kidneys and your liver. And now, you know, if you take too much food, then you obviously have to treat yourself again for cholesterol, for blood pressure, for this, that and the other. So, this is why I say I was very happy when we had ice cream the other day. Because, you know, these things are good experiments for me. You know, I know I have still some way to go. So I'm always using everyday situations to test how far I've come. Every day, every situation is a litmus test for me. How much more raga, dvesha, moha do I have in me? Are there still things that I come into conflict with? Are there still things that draw me so, you know, with so much desire, so much lust? And that is the real test for me. How far am I from Nibbana? And how did I react to that situation yesterday? To how do I do it today? Do I handle that situation better? Do I still feel the same fire within me? Ragagini, Dveshagini, Mohagini? Or do I feel that I've quenched that fire a little bit? I've put it out a little bit. If so, I'm walking on the right path and I'm making progress. If I feel that it's gotten worse, then something's wrong in the way I practice it. I'm just going to check if we have any questions on the radio.
Yes, I have a question.
Sure.
Why do you feel you are going to overcome your past experience and experience with this new thing? How is the cost in your mind? In pain or what will happen?
What sort of past experience have you
had?
Give me an example.
Having or some feeling, I can say that. But if it's coming to your mind, with this thing, past experience, somehow we can't eradicate at once. So it, does it give you a pain, or does it give you this kind of pain? So how do you overcome this kind of past experience?
That's a very, very good question. I'll come to that question, I'll repeat the question so our listeners online can understand what we're talking about. Just before I go into that, there's someone that's posted a question here saying, when we are trying to get the number of meals down to one a day, can we still drink water or take some drink? And that's perfectly fine. Because remember, if we're taking food as a medication for an ailment. What is the ailment here? Hunger. So if you're feeling hungry and you can quench that hunger by taking drink, there's nothing wrong with that. But you can't just keep drinking water 24/7 every day of the week because your body needs food to survive. You know, clearly I'm not prescribing, you know, stop taking solid meals completely. I'd be foolish and silly to do that. That is not what I'm prescribing. I'm not prescribing anything. All I'm saying, this is what I'm doing. I'm not a doctor to prescribe anything. Right? I'm not Shastra Maharaj either. All I'm saying is, this is what I do. And what I did was cut down my solid meal, solid food down to one a day, and gave you my story of how it impacted me. And if you're feeling, again, you know, that's a good test. Now, if you're feeling thirsty, you know, when my friends, sometimes they, you know, they tell me, when I was a lay person, you know, Mashan, shall we have a drink? And, you know, we're talking about like a soft drink, right? And I say, okay, yeah, sure. I ask him, sure, can I get you some water? No. You know, do you have any Sprite or Coke or anything like that? And then I go, what's the problem? I'm thirsty. Okay, so have water then. What's wrong with water? But then they go, no, I need some. Why? I don't not offer it to them, but you know, I only do this with some friends. Just, you know, some of my friends know that I'm practicing this way of thinking. And others, you know, I wouldn't in a million years say something like that to them. You just, you know, give them what they want. But you know, have any drinks you like. And as I say, you know, this is ultimately about why are you taking food, right? That's the only question you need to ask yourself. Why am I taking this food? Am I taking this food to please my taste buds? Or am I taking this food to cure a disease, an ailment, which is hunger? And to survive and to provide the nutrients that I need to practice the Dhamma. That's why we take food. Okay, so I hope that answers clears that question. So going back to a question that was posed to us by a gentleman here. So he was saying, and I'll paraphrase this, correct me if I misunderstood it. So we have previous experiences in our life, that could be to do with food, it could be to do with how we associate with friends, you know, chatting with them, or it could be a party, yeah. How we go, to, you know, either our interest in a party, or even when you go to a party, how we behave in a, you know, in a party kind of environment,
reading,
social environment,
reading novels, hobbies,
yeah, things like that. And how has that impacted me? I think you're asking my experience when I then decided that was not the kind of life that I wanted. Is that your question? Okay. If you had a child, you probably have children, and you say you took them a toy. It's a toy in a box, a cardboard box. You give this box with a toy inside to your child, your baby, you know, child, say they're, I don't know, three years of age, for argument's sake. And what are you now expecting the child to do? Open the box, take the toy out, and play with it, right? What the child actually does is he tries to open the box, and then he sees his sellotape. There's a bit of sellotape that has kept this the lid of the box closed and stuff. He takes his bit of sellotape and he walks away with his bit of sellotape. Of what you've offered him, the thing that he found most interesting, most exciting, is that bit of sellotape. He has no interest in the toy. Now you and I are sat here wondering, what on earth are you thinking? I've just brought you something so valuable that you should clearly find value in, find pleasure in, that is this toy. You've just removed a bit of sellotape from this box, and now you're going and playing with that. There is no value in that. What are you doing? You then approach the child, and you go put it, or do it. Yeah, play with this toy. Look what Tati has brought for you. Play with this toy. The child expresses, you know, dissatisfied. No, I'm not interested in that. I just want to play with this. It's just a bit of sellotape. And then you'll think, you should have told me that before. I wouldn't have gone and spent money on getting you a toy. I would have just brought you a bit of sellotape. Now, if you try and then force the child to play with the toy, and remove that forcefully, get that bit of sellotape out of his hand, what do you think is going to happen? The child's going to cry. He's going to cry your ears out. Why? Because he's so attached to the sellotape, he thinks that's what's going to give him happiness. He finds it really interesting, whether it's the look of it, how it sticks to his hand, or the noise it makes, whatever it might be. So he just wants to play this bit of sellotape, right? So you decide, okay, fine. Play with the sellotape. You put the toy to a side. You don't take it away from you, just keep it to a side. A day passes. A few days pass. A few weeks pass. One day the child walks up to the toy. Or the toy is still in the box. Because, you know, he took it out, he's not interested, he just put it back in the box and said, hopefully one day. And this one day has now come. The child now pulls the toy out of the box and starts playing with it. He's no longer interested in that sellotape. What did you do to impact that, to influence that? Absolutely nothing. Why? Because the child has come to an understanding themselves, himself or herself, that actually what's of value is this toy, not the bit of sellotape. There is no value in that. But when you try to take it away forcefully, it would cry. Today, if you go and remove that bit of sellotape, he couldn't care less. Even if it was stuck to his hand, he's now playing with the toy, you remove that bit of sellotape, he wouldn't care less. But something that he found so much value and so much pleasure in a few weeks ago. You see where I'm going with this? When you feel, when you think that happiness lies within a certain thing you do, a certain thing that you possess, that could be a person, it could be an object, it could be an idea. You know, sometimes we are stuck to ideas. When you are stuck to it, when you find that this is what's going to give me happiness, I'm so attached to it, and you try and pull it away, that is when you feel anger, frustration, disappointment, sorrow, grief. But once you come to an understanding, hang on a second, where is happiness in this? I thought this was going to give me happiness, but happiness does not live within me. This object that I thought was so precious is not precious to me. It's useless. This person that I thought was looking after me, was so caring of me, actually, you know, he's tricking me or she's tricking me. I couldn't think of a worse person to associate with. I don't wish to associate with this person anymore. And then take that person away. You're perfectly fine. In fact, you might even wish, can someone please take this person away from me? So in my experience, a lot of the things that I used to do, I was addicted to my laptop. When I come home from work, I mean, work is always on the computer for me. It was a desk-based job. 24/7. While I was at work, I was always on the computer. When I came home from work, I'm still in my tie, sit down in front of the computer and start working again. My wife would prepare a cup of tea and come over to where I was, where I had my desk in the bedroom and say, you know, shall we go have tea? And sure, just give me a minute, I'll be with you in a minute. A minute passes. 5 minutes pass. 10 minutes pass. And she'll come and remind me again, shall we have that tea? Yeah, sure, just give me another 5 minutes. Another 5 minutes pass. She's given up. Now she's angry. I was addicted to my phone. I couldn't put it down. I always wanted to know what was going on. Who had emailed me? Every time it went, I could hear a ringtone. Now that could be a message, a text message or an email message. Or it could be some kind of notification, Facebook, WhatsApp. I had to know what it was about. Who had texted me? I'm so important. Someone needs my interaction. I need to get involved. This world is going to stop if I step away. The world's going to stop revolving as soon as I step away from it. Well, actually, I've stopped using my computer and my phone, and the world's still revolving. Apparently, it doesn't need me as much as I thought it did. So when I was so attached to those things, let me share with you this. I used to sing publicly, on stage. In fact, I took part in a competition, very similar to, actually it was called London Star, they ran a London Star. I took part in that competition, and I got to the semi-finals. We started with about, I think, several hundred contestants, and after several rounds, I think I got through to the last 10, if I remember, several years back, 2015 maybe, if I remember right. I really liked music. I went to music lessons. So clearly, when we had a party, you know, I was the center of attention. People wanted me to sing a song, and I thought, oh, great. I even sometimes, when I went to a party, like, one problem I had was I could never remember lyrics. So I had apps installed on my phone, so I could find the words. Or sometimes I would secretly take a book of lyrics in a bag, just in case someone asked me to sing a song, because I would never want to step back and say, no, I'm not going to sing. Why? You know, I'm important. I need to be center stage. So I liked parties. I like to go see friends, I like to talk to them, have a chat, see what's going on in the world. Who else needs me? What can I do? And if you had tried to take all of that away, then I would have found that very frustrating. I would have found that very painful. It's only after I listened to the Dhamma and realized, what on earth am I doing? Is this what I have struggled so hard, I have worked so hard to get this, to be born a human being? Is this what I'm spending something so precious, something so valuable on? Entertaining other people? Entertaining myself? Singing songs? Dancing? Everyone does that. Once I realized how I'm only here on a visa. What do I mean by that? I've been born a human on a visa. As soon as my visa runs out, I'm back in the hells, in the apaya. In the animal world, in the pereta world, in the niraya world, in the asura world. This is a very short visa. If you take the time I've spent in samsara, this is just a flash. The time that I spent on this, I have spent and I will spend in this human world is just a flash. It's a moment compared to how long I've been in samsara. And yet, I have spent years and years and years in the apart. Now that I'm born a human, is this what I spend my human life on? When I understood the suffering that people go through, that animals, the beings in the apayas go through, my goodness, I couldn't think of anything else other than I need to do everything I can now do to ensure I don't go back in there again. When I came across Anicca-dukkha-anatta, the philosophy that the Lord Buddha taught me, I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, when I was growing up, at a very young age, I was very interested in Buddhism. I used to go and spend time in meditation retreats. I spent a week there, 2 weeks there, trying to find the Buddha's teaching. When I learned Abhidharma for the first time, I was really interested, because I thought, okay, so this must be, you know, this is the most profound Dhamma, the most difficult thing. If you understood this, you've got it. You've attained Nibbana. My parents sent me to an English Dhamma school, because they thought that was better. Most parents do, right? If it's in English, it's better. I mean, that's not why we preach in English. It's only because to help other people who can't understand things. You know, there's no fault in that. But when I was growing up, I was really looking for the Buddha's teaching. I learned gathas, I learned pirit, I learned this, that, another. And I could never link. You know, my dad was a scientist, and he always taught me to think logically. He always said, don't just take things just because someone says it. No, everything we learn in Kalamasutra, that the Lord Buddha taught. Don't just take something just because you read it in a book, just because your teacher says it is so, just because, you know, you think that is the way it is. Analyze it. Just because it's been handed down generation to generation. Don't just accept it for, you know, on face value. Take it, analyze it, does it make sense? Are there bits and pieces where it doesn't add up? You know, that is why Buddhism is a science. Before we accept something is true in science, we experiment, right? You come up with a hypothesis, then you experiment. And until your experiment proves that, yes, I've tried experimenting it in one way, another way, and another way, and all three give me the same result, then I can confidently come to a conclusion that my hypothesis is either correct, true or false. So I want to do the same thing. And when I practice, I used to go to meditation classes at the age of 12, 13. And they used to teach me, you know, practice anapanasati. Breathing in, breathing out. And I asked them, okay, so I've been doing this now for a week. I can still feel my breath going in and out. How is this going to help me attain Nibbana? When will I know I've attained Nibbana? When will I know at least I've attained the first Margabana, that is Sotapanna? How am I going to know it? And the answer was always, you will when you know it. You will know it when you know it. To me, that couldn't be something that the Lord Buddha would have taught. I can't imagine the Lord Buddha, you know, someone walking up to the Lord Buddha and saying, Venerable Sir, this is my philosophy. If you live like a dog, or if you subject your body to physical pain, once you've consumed or once you've expired all the bad karmas you've done in the past, you then no longer have to suffer. You can, from that point on, live a happy life. That makes logic to me. I'm not saying I accept that. That was a teaching, a philosophy that existed in the time of the Lord Buddha. That was not the Lord Buddha's preaching, but that was a philosophy. And, you know, there's some logic there. If you've done so much bad karma, so much good karma, you know, if you imagine you had a bank account, right? You have a negative balance and a positive balance, two bank accounts. And the bank says, you owe us money. For me to owe the bank money, I need to owe the bank more money than I have in my second bank account. So as soon as I've got more money saved up than the money I owe them, then I no longer, you know, the net value is the bank has now has my money. I don't owe the maximum money. So it makes logical sense. So for me to think someone like that would walk up to the Lord Buddha and say, okay, what is your philosophy? And the Lord Buddha would then say, oh, practice anapanasati, breathe in, breathe out, and you will know that you have attained Nibbana when you do. That didn't make sense to me. So I always had a question mark. And then, I mean, there was a time when, and I'm ashamed to say this today. I'm ashamed to say this today, that there was a time I used to say, how do we know that the Lord Buddha ever understood anything? Could he not have been a crazy person? Because there were lots of crazy people around at that time. You know, there were his contemporaries who were just crazy. Crazy as in they had a certain view, a wrong view of this is what I need to do to end suffering. And some people had gone crazy, and, you know, they would have said, I have attained, you know, the supreme enlightenment or the supreme bliss. You know, I am your teacher, you know, learn from me. Some people are either actually crazy or some just had a wrong view. And I used to question, well, how do we know the Lord Buddha wasn't someone like that? Or, you know, Prince Siddhartha wasn't someone like that? today I can't believe I said something like that. But the reality is, until I came across the Lord Buddha's teaching, I suppose it is forgivable for someone to question that. So when I came across the Lord Buddha's teaching, and then I realized that makes perfect sense. If Nibbana is the eradication of raga, dvesha, moha, lust, hatred or conflict, mental conflict and ignorance, and then eradication of those takes you to Nibbana, and to do that is something I can do every day through everyday practice, and by looking at the world through the lens of anicca, dukkha and anatta, I can see that that happens. Now I can say, yes, I know now what Nibbana is, I know what the problem is. I know how anicca, dukkha, anatta can treat the problem, and how that can take me to Nibbana. So the path is clear to me now. Today, I don't doubt the Buddha. But you see, no wonder that the Buddha talks about, the dasavastaka mityadha. Or silapata paramasa. When the Lord Buddha says, until you've understood, or until you become a sotapanna, you practice various ways of life, various practices, in the hope of attaining Nibbana. You doubt the Buddha, you doubt the Dhamma, you doubt the Sangha. No wonder, he was perfectly right when he said that, until you listen to this Dhamma and you understand it. So until that happened to me, I was one of them. So, the question was, how have I managed to remove myself from the things I used to enjoy, the things I used to find pleasure in as a lay person? It's nothing I've done forcefully. It's nothing someone has had to force on me. And it's not something that I do because I think if I stop doing that, then I'm going to be happy. It's actually quite the opposite. I now see that happiness does not lie in doing those things. Happiness does not exist in going to parties or eating different kinds of food, talking to friends all the time. That is not where happiness lies. Happiness now for me is actually by being by myself, reflecting on the Lord Buddha's Dhamma, reflecting on the supreme qualities of the Lord Buddha. How great he was, what a character he was. How great his Dhamma was, his teaching. How profound, how beautiful his teaching was. And the qualities of the Mahasangha, the likes of Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Moggallana. And how much I can learn from them. Just reflecting on those brings within my heart so much happiness. And that happiness is the happiness that's going to take me towards Nirvana. It's going to drive me, it's going to support me on my way to Nirvana. Let's have another look to see if there are any other questions. So there's a question on the web radio. It says, Bhante, I'm addicted to my iPad, I think, a lot. And I have no one here to play with me. I am the only child to my parents. Kindly tell me, how do I ignore my addiction? And I want to know how to become a sotapanna. Okay. So, I think the answer to the question lies within the question itself. I think this, when the question was asked, I don't know if the person that asked the question realized, actually the answer to the question is within the question itself. I'll repeat the question is, I am addicted to my iPad a lot. And then he or she goes on to say, I am the only child to my parents. I have no one here to play with. So, this addiction to an iPad, and as I said before, I used to be addicted to my phone, my laptop. There are others in this room that used to be addicted to their phone. This is because, and in this person's case, you know, he or she says that he's the only child in the family and no one to play with. So, it appears that this device or this thing that is the iPad offers them something that they look for, which they would normally find in having someone to play with. Now, I think it's worthwhile actually speaking to friends and family who have siblings, brothers and sisters, and asking them if they are not addicted to iPads and phones. And I think what you will find is it makes no difference whether you have brothers or sisters. If you're going to be addicted, you're going to be addicted. The reason that we get addicted to these things, like, you know, and it's not just devices like phones and iPads, you know, people are addicted to television. Some people are addicted to music, to the radio. You know, I know some people that can't actually do any work, sit down and do any work, whether that's their school work or office work, unless they have some music plugged in their ears. And that's the kind of addiction. Some people are addicted to food. So, a lot of people are addicted to one thing or another. Now, a lot of the time, you know, things like phones and iPads, you know, they offer, in this day and age, things like Facebook and Twitter, and things like that. You've got to question yourself, what am I looking for? When I go on Facebook, what am I looking for? This is what I said, you know, allow that plant to grow. You need to have that conversation. Just like before you go and eat that chocolate in the fridge that you don't need, or to come to the conclusion whether you do need or don't need, you need to have that conversation with yourself. So you need to have a conversation with yourself. Okay, you now want to go on Facebook. So imagine, you know, you're sat down, you've got your phone on your table, your mind saying, right, let's go on Facebook. And then you get into a contract. Contract is, okay mind, I'll let you go on Facebook, but first, can you please tell me what it is you're looking for on Facebook? And then your mind is probably going to say something like, well, you know, your friends, you've got to know what's going on. Are they okay? You've heard it beep before. Maybe they've sent you a message. Maybe they want your attention. Maybe something's going on. Maybe you need to be involved. And then you ask your mind again, okay, so what? You want to know what's going on out there. Why? Why do you need to know what's going on out there? So you're now asking your mind this question. Why do you need to know what's going on in the world, with the world? You know, as we said last week, right? People sit down on the toilet and then they scroll through Facebook. It's become a part of life now. It's like breathing in oxygen. People have to have their Facebook with them. And I think 99% of people, they don't actually go on Facebook to check their messages. What they do is, you know, they have this thing called the Facebook wall, right? You just keep scrolling on the Facebook wall. One thing after the other. Picture, video, audio, whatever it is, you just keep scrolling. Oh, there's, you know, someone talking about something. Oh, what's next? Or someone having a fight with the other person. Oh, what's next? Someone saying how much they love another person. Oh, what's next? Oh, something's happening in the world somewhere. There's been an earthquake or something. You just need to know what's going on. Why do you need to know what's going on? Then you ask yourself the question, what if I couldn't give you what you're asking for. What happens then? Now, you're not saying I'm not going to give you. Okay, no, that's fine. I will allow you to go on Facebook, but first let's have this conversation. And believe me, you only need to have this conversation a few times. After the first few times, you will realize for yourself, you no longer need to go on Facebook as much as you needed to. So if it's the first time, you are now having this conversation for the first time and you're going, okay, so why do you need to know what's going on in the world? And then your mind goes, so the question you ask is, what happens if I now put you into a dark room and lock you in? Could you survive? And your mind goes, maybe. And then you can go, okay, right, let's try out that then. So you put the phone to a side, you know, you don't have to literally go into a dark room, but okay, in a dark room, locked dark room, you're not going to have access to Facebook, keep it to a side. 5 minutes pass, 10 minutes pass, maybe half an hour, and now your mind's going, I need that Facebook now. Okay, so then you go back to that conversation, right. So, yeah, I'm still not saying I'm not going to give you Facebook. I promise you I will give you Facebook if you still need it after we've had this conversation. And then you go, so, your phone or your iPad or your Facebook, you wanted to know what's going on. Why do you need this? If I give it to you now, once, are you going to be happy forever? No, I want to know today, and then maybe again in half an hour I want to know again. And maybe tomorrow I want to know again. Why? What have you actually gained? Have you not been in the same situation countless times before? Have you not felt the urge, felt that strong desire like your life depends on you going online and checking what's going on countless times before? And every time you felt that you succumbed, you gave in, you said, okay, fine, go do it. What did you gain out of it? You got more and more addicted. If someone's addicted to heroin, to drugs, how do people say you've got to remove them from that addiction? You stop giving that person whatever that they're addicted to. That could be gradual. It could be straight off. That's it, no more. First it might struggle. It's gonna fight. Because, you know, your mind was thinking, life depends on this. How can I live without heroin? That, you know, I can't breathe without it. I need that drug within my body. My heart can't beat without it. My brain can't function without it. The sole reason I'm alive is because I've got this drug in my body. This addiction is no different. But after a little while, aren't there patients that think that they're addicted and their lives depend on it, that then get cured? So how did they cure themselves? How were they cured if their life actually depended on it? Well, the reality is, no one's life depends on heroin. No one's life depends on Facebook. No one's life depends on iPads or iPods or whatever, or music. These addictions are man-made, are mind-made. But if you feed that person more heroin when they're asking for it, do you think you're ever going to break that addiction? Because it thinks, okay, I got it this time. And it feels, you know, your mind's waiting for, you know, it's suffering. It's suffering and it's waiting, it's lamenting. It's saying, I need it, I need it, I need it. It's really tormenting inside. And then you give it. The moment you give it, it feels like, oh, I got what I was looking for. And it feels that sense of achievement. That feeling of achievement is what your mind's looking for. You know, your mind goes into so much stress, torment, pain, and then you give it what it's asking for, and then it feels, finally I've achieved it. But why is that very short-lived? If you've achieved it, why do you need it again? Why do you need to keep feeding the person that's addicted to heroin more and more heroin? You know that when people say, I just need, this is the last time, I'm never going to drink again. You know how some people are addicted to drink? I'm never going to drink again, this is the last time, that's it, I promise. Or I'm never going to smoke again, last one, I promise. And you give it. And then they feel, finally I got it. Is that really the last time? I mean, some people, you know, they are very strong-willed. They have the energy to fight that urge. But it's fighting that urge that allows them to win. Not, I need another one, give me this next one and then I will give up. That's not what helps them break that addiction. So, going back to this person's question about addiction to electronic devices. The problem with our minds, just like our bodies, you know, like when our bodies are hungry, we feed. That's a very temporary cure. Feeding our bodies, feeding our stomachs is not a permanent cure. That's why we have to keep doing it. Our minds are always looking for vedana sanya. Feeling, perception and identification. Your mind wants to know something's going on and then it wants to identify what's going on. If you hear something happening in the next room, you all you need to hear is a noise. Imagine you're alone at home. You hear something, or you know, you don't have to actually be alone. You could, you know, you hear, you know, your brothers in the next room, your sisters in the next room, someone else in the family is in the next room, and you hear something that you've never heard before. Some kind of noise. Maybe it's an electronic noise of some sort. You want to know what's going on. This is why when you walk past the TV and the TV is on, you feel this sudden urge to have a quick glance. What's going on the TV? You know you're not going to sit down there and watch it, but oftentimes what happens is you take that glance and now you want to sit down and watch it. You completely forget what you came there to do. You know, it may be that you were studying, you know, you were reading something, you were reading a book, doing your homework, or something else. You come out of your bedroom, you walk past your living room, you see the TV, you see some, you know, a dialogue. Say there's a teledrama, or a movie, or someone's watching a cartoon. Your brother's watching a cartoon, your sister's watching a cartoon. And then you see something going on there, a little dialogue. Now you're addicted. Now you want to sit down and watch the rest of it. Why? You've just given your mind something to feel, something to perceive, and something to identify, something to recognize. As soon as that happens, you know, if it was the same, this is, you know, I've asked this question before. How many times can you watch the same episode of Simpsons? You can watch it once. The first time you watch it, you take so much pleasure out of it. Why? Because with every passing second, you're giving your mind new food. You're giving your mind new feelings, new perceptions. And with every passing second, your mind is trying to identify that, trying to recognize that. But the second time you watch it, you know what's going to happen. So imagine you are walking past the TV, you've left your homework in your bedroom, you're walking past the TV, you see an episode of Simpsons. This is the first time it's being played on TV. You have a quick glance at it, and now you're stood there with whatever you brought with you in your hand. You completely forgot what you came there for, and now you're stood there watching the TV until, you know, someone says, "Puta, what are you doing here? Do you not have your work to do?" And you say, "Yeah, sure, just one minute. Just want to know what's going to happen next." Has this not happened to you? It's happened to all of us. It's happened to me. Today, as we were going to this monastery, we stopped on the way by a shop because one of the monks, he wanted to get something from the shop. Now, I don't know what it is that he wanted, but he was sat in the front and he spoke to the driver and he said, "Can you go and get, you know, whatever it is that he wanted?" So the driver got out of the van, he went to the shop, He brought it back, and then as he was giving it to the monk, he said, I've tried to squeeze it, but it's gone dry. So, maybe we'll need to get a new one. Now, I didn't know what this was. If you were in that situation, what would be the first thought that would come into your mind? What are they talking about? If you didn't know what it was, something to do with squeezing something, it's dried up. Now you're thinking, is it a tube? Is it a tube? Is it a tube of toothpaste? Is it a tube of superglue? Is it a tube of medicine? Something else? What is it? What did he ask for? Your mind starts asking all these questions. What for? Why do you need to know that? What have you ever gained by knowing what's going on out there? Now, fortunately, when these thoughts pass my mind today, I see them in a flash. And the thought came into my mind. What might they be talking about? And then the second thought that came to my mind was, why do you need to know? What do you need to know about that for? Has it got anything to do with you? Someone wanted something, he asked someone else to go and get it for him, he came back and reported on it or gave something back. What have you got to do anything with that situation? Absolutely nothing. You know when the tsunamis hit Sri Lanka? A lot of people died because of what? Curiosity. Have you heard the saying, curiosity kills the cat? A lot of people died in the tsunami because of curiosity. As the water subdued back into the ocean, people were curious. How come? There's, you know, all this land that was underwater. There's no water in there anymore. There's fish jumping up and down. You know, the water had subdued, had been taken back into the ocean. So there was like, you know, the beach was much larger than it was normally. Because all the water had been pulled back into the ocean. Because that's the way the tsunami works. There's like a big gap. The water then goes and fills that gap. And then two tectonic plates push back together again. And then that brings a big wave of water that had now filled that gap, you know, pushed all of that back onto the shore. So there were scores and scores of people that walked into the beach and walked further into the sea, obviously now without water, to see what was going on, what was happening. And then before they knew it, minutes later, there was this big tidal wave, 20, 30 foot high. Now it was too late. There was nowhere they could run to escape that. If you think to yourself, the number of times you would have gotten in trouble because of curiosity. You know, think about sometimes how when there are, you know, people fight. Like, I mean, you know, back when there was a war in Sri Lanka, and there was I remember my parents telling me the story, when they had bombed the Central Bank or the Twin Towers, not the Twin Towers, sorry, the World Trade Center in Sri Lanka. The World Trade Center in Sri Lanka, many years ago. First there was a small blast. What happened then? Everyone wanted to know what had gone on. Many people went over there, you know, after a few hours after the blast, a lot of people gathered, walked over to see what had gone on. What was going on, you know, what was the problem? And then came the bigger blast. See, this desire to know what's going on and to identify it, to recognize it, that gets us into trouble so much, I can't begin to explain. If you now come back to, you know, the way we live our lives, right? We see something with our eyes, we want to go and find out what's going on. Our ears, you know, our mind. When I was doing some meditation recently, this is a thought that came into my mind. The sole purpose of our mind's existence is to recognize, to take feeling, to know that something is going on, and I say something, as in it could be anything. Something is going on, and now I need to know what it is. This is why we shake our legs when we sat down. You know, next time you sat down somewhere and you start shaking your legs and you don't even know you're doing it, stop for a moment and think, hang on a second, why am I doing this? Because your mind is looking for that Vedana Sanya. Your mind is looking for something. I need to know something's going on. I need some feeling. So your mind sends a signal to your legs, you know, start shaking. And you don't even know it. It's happening. You know how sometimes you start tapping on the table. Like, you know, a song comes into mind and you start tapping. Or sometimes you hear something and you start tapping. Why? Because now your mind needs that physical sensation. So what your mind does, the sole purpose of your mind's existence is to understand this world. To take in signals through your five senses. Your eyes, your ears, your nose, your tongue, and your physical body. And then give it identification. To give it, you know, to know what's going on out there. And if it can't get it from any of those five, the mind starts its own journey. This is when people just start going into their mental worlds and start dreaming, into dream world. You know how we say they dream, yes. When the five senses stop feeding it, then mind's going to daydream more. You know, what if this happened? Or what if that happened? Or if only she had looked at me one more time. Oh, how much I would have loved it. Oh, how her hair must feel. Daydream. You know, you're thinking how it must feel, how it must look like, how it must feel like, hear like. You know, your senses are now not feeding your mind, but your mind is creating mental images of this is what it may feel like if your five senses were operating at that time. Don't you feel that your five senses are slaves to your mind? Your eyes, your ears, your nose, your tongue, and your body are slaves, are absolute slaves to your mind. They get nothing out of it. And it's this slavery that takes you in samsara. And not just that, that's only half the story. Here's where it gets worse. Because your mind needs those sensations, it gets the eyes, the ears, the tongue, the nose, and the physical body. And not only does it get that, but now you need to suffer to maintain them as well. Why? Because they decay, they get diseases, they grow old, and they die. Who suffers? You. When your eyes stop working, when you go blind, when you go deaf, now you're suffering. You brought these slaves, your mind brought these slaves with it to support it, to constantly feed it information for no value whatsoever, for no purpose whatsoever. A completely useless existence. Because, you know, for all the things that I've seen in my years of existence, for all the things that I've heard in my years, many years of existence. And you know, each of us needs to think for ourselves. How many years have I been alive? For all the things that I've seen, for all the years of things that I've heard, for all the years of things that I've tasted, am I satisfied today? Do I no longer need to see things? Do I no longer need to hear anything else? Do I no longer need to taste anything else or feel anything else? No, I still do. So when is it ever enough? This master, that is the mind, never gives up. you can never satisfy it. It never finds fulfillment. And so these slaves are constant slaves. You know how we talk about abolishing slavery? Where do you think it needs to start? Abolishing slavery needs to start within yourself. Because your eyes, your nose, your tongue, your ears, and your body are slaves to your mind. Abolish slavery. Understand that these slaves are not fed, they're not paid, they're not allowed to have any spare time. Oh no. The only time your body gets a bit of rest is because your mind goes, oh, you know, you're not giving me the you know, your mind is not capable now, because it's been, your mind has been awake for so long, and your mind needs a rest, and therefore your senses can now go to rest. But as soon as the mind wakes up, come on, get back up, come on. Start feeding me. Abolishing slavery needs to start within yourself, not out there, not out in the world. You know, this is what I was thinking the other day. Why have I become a slave to my mind? And if those slaves got paid, at least you can say it's worthwhile. But no. What payment do I get? What do my ears, eyes get for all the hard work that it does? What do my ears get for all the hard work it does? When my mind thinks that it needs to go and eat from a restaurant, my poor body now needs to work, right? It needs to go to work, earn money. Who's suffering? This body is suffering. Save money, now go and find a vehicle. Go online, or you know, go and speak to someone, or find, you know, ring up a restaurant, make all the bookings, do all of that, then either walk there or drive there, go and sit down. All this effort for what? And then you know, your eyes, your mind says, okay, eyes, come on, take in all the sights. What does the food look like? I need to know. And then your eyes go to work, then your ears go to work. You know, the wine glasses banging into each other, you know, the sounds you get in a restaurant, because without that you're thinking, where am I? This is not a restaurant. You need some music to be played in the background so your mind can enjoy. If you know you're going to a barbecue, you need to see hear the crackling noises out there. Your mind is using your senses as slaves. Wake up. Wake up and realize that this is daylight robbery. This is daylight slavery. This is why Shastra Mohanse says, this is why he talks about Indriya Bhavana, or meditation of the senses. He says, it's not about closing your eyes, shutting your eyes, or shutting your ears, or shutting your nose, or shutting your tongue, and saying, no, I'm no longer taking anything through these senses. It's about, think about what you're doing. Get into that contract. Before you give your mind what, you know, through your eyes, what it's asking for, have that dialogue with your mind. Hang on a second, mind. What are you asking for, again? Oh, you want to go and watch that movie. Why? You've seen movies before. I've worked so hard. I've trained my eyes. Have you never stayed up late at night, you know, scrolling on the internet, your iPad or your phone? Your eyes are really tired now, but you still don't want to go to sleep. Well, your eyes want to go to sleep, but your mind doesn't. So what does your mind do? Well, your eyes are slaves, right? Oh, come on, slaves. I want to be awake. Keep working. I don't care whether your eyes are, you have become teary, whether the eyes have become red. I don't care. Just keep working for me. You're my slaves. And sometimes when you want to go somewhere, no matter how tired your body is, your mind will still make it happen. You know how they say that the flesh is weak but the mind is willing? Sometimes our bodies are so tired you can't do anything. But if your mind is strong enough, well, no wonder, because your body is a slave to your mind. Your mind will make it work. In the Shastrashasana, the Lord Buddha's teaching is, stop that. Realize that your mind is making slaves out of your five senses. Realize that all your mind is doing is making your five senses run errands for it. Go do this, go do that, bring me this, bring me that. How long are you going to keep doing this? How many times in your past births have you done this? Is your mind satisfied? Imagine someone asks you to come and do some work for them for a period of time. And they say, work for me for, say, a year. And I will pay you for it. After you work for me for a year, I'll be happy, you can go. And you say, okay, right, I'll come and do it. You work for a year. And they go, actually no, you need to work for another year. And you go, okay, fine, right, I'll trust you. But don't lie to me again. I'll do it this time as well. You do it again. Well, lo and behold, that year comes to an end. Surprise, surprise, they want you to work for them another year. Have we not done that throughout samsara? Every time our minds have said, go and get me sights, go and get me sounds, go and get me tastes, go and get me physical sensations, go and get me smells, your senses have just gone run errands for it. And your body has suffered so much for it. You have suffered so much pain, so much grief, so much pain, and this mind has taken you through samsara. Losing your loved ones, suffering ailments, diseases. You know, how many times have we had to cure wounds, diseases? It's not the mind that suffers because of that. As in, it's not the mind that has to endure that pain. If you hurt your body, then you need to treat your body. But the mind, to the mind is just a slave. The slave is wounded, get healed as soon as you can. Because you need to come back and work for me again. That's all it cares about. So, when you think about addictions, think for a moment, why am I addicted to this? Reflect on your addiction. What am I doing? Why am I straining my eyes? Who for? This mind that is full of lust, full of anger, full of delusion, full of raga, dvesha, moha. This mind, this is why a Rahatan Mahansa doesn't need to go and see things. This is why a Rahatan Mahansa doesn't want to go and hear and listen to things. Why? Because they have tamed their minds. Their minds no longer use their senses as slaves. Your mind is the only thing that can tame itself. For that, you need a teacher. And as the Lord Buddha has said, my Dhamma is your teacher. When I am not here, when Venerable Ananda asks, when the Lord Buddha was on the Tirunivan Manchakai, oh Venerable Sir, when you are no longer with us, who is going to be our teacher? And the Lord Buddha says, Ananda, when I am no longer with you, my Dhamma is your teacher. He didn't say, a monk is going to come along in 2000 years, his name is going to be this, that person is going to be your teacher. He didn't say, this person is going to be your teacher. He didn't say, any particular person was going to be your teacher. All he said, my Dhamma is going to be your teacher. So when you and I want to learn the Dhamma, want to practice the Dhamma, we've got to be very careful if we find ourselves becoming disciples of individuals. Always look for the Dhamma. Always make your Dhamma your teacher. Don't be a disciple. Don't be a follower. Be a student. Don't be a follower. A student learns, analyzes, and tries to understand. A follower doesn't question. Never be a follower. Be a student. You have your teacher. Now be a student. Okay, let's see if you have any other questions. Please make the necessary arrangements to post the sermon on YouTube. Okay, we'll post this on YouTube, no problem. I think those are the only questions online. Do any of you have any questions? No? Okay. Right, in which case, we don't have any more questions. We will bring today's sermon to an end. I'll make sure that this sermon gets posted on YouTube. And before next week, I mean, if you do have questions, there's certainly no harm in posting them as we discuss. But if you have questions that you think of. Because, you know, sometimes what happens is you think of a question when you come across a situation day to day, and then you forget it by the time you come to the Deshana. So if you have that question, as soon as you can get in front of a computer or your phone, just put it on online. On Skype would be best, because then we have a record of that, and then we can go back to those questions. And if I need to refer to Tripitaka, then I can make those references and provide some answers that way as well. Okay, in which case we will bring today's Deshana to an end. May all the merits that you have acquired throughout today's program by listening to the Deshana and to the Deshakan Vanse who has preached today's Deshana, may all the merits that you have acquired and the merits that you have extended to the Devas, the Brahmas, and all those relations and relatives that you invited at the start, may we all use these merits, may all the merits that we've acquired support us to attain the supreme bliss that is enlightenment in the Tathagata Sambuddha Shasane, in the Gautama Samma Sambuddha Shasane itself. May all beings be well and happy, may all beings attain the supreme bliss that is Nibbana. Therwan Sarnam.